Hello and welcome to ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, the radio show where events of history are examined through the discussion of books, journal articles, papers, and presentations. Then historians and history buffs ask the question, what is relevant or irrelevant in today's world? My name is John Keeley, and this is the 559th show of ROI. Our noted guest for today's show is Dr. Patrick Lyndon, author of the book, The Case Against Death. Joining us in the second segment of our show are history buffs Rick Sweet and Brett Menard. To begin with, we'd like to welcome you to our show. Patrick, how are you doing?
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. We call the first segment of the show Faderukta Narin, and our goal is to give our listeners a little background on today's subject. So can you start us off with some basic information on how the philosophy has traditionally thought about death and mortality?
Well, I think that there's been a project from the beginning of history trying to explain why we need to accept death and also aging, the framing conditions of our lives. And usually there is a kind of story whereby the common man is complaining about the brevity of life, and then the wise man says, well, you are complaining about how short life is, but really it's a blessing in disguise, or it would be worse if you lived longer, or something of that sort. Of course, all of that is known as apologism in the history of thoughts about death. Thanatology is exactly this project of, in one way or another, explaining why death is acceptable, at least neutral, and perhaps even good for humans. That it's not something that we should try to fight against, but live with, so to speak.
Okay, so,
and,
I'm sorry.
Go on. There are many different versions of this. Of course, one is the religious one, where you say, well, death is not bad because it's the beginning of a new kind of life, and this new kind of life is not bad. But there is also a more naturalistic version of this, that perhaps you could say the Stoics or the Epicureans would represent, saying that, well, it's a kind of good thing that life ends because your troubles are over, for example. That is, they don't try to justify death by or denying death, but accepting death and still saying that it's a good thing. And in my book, then, in The Case Against Death, what I'm doing is I'm making an argument primarily against the philosophical tradition that is trying to say that death is all right, even if it means that everything is over forever.
Okay. So can I ask, where did you get your premises for the argument of your book then?
Well, it's sort of as a feeling that I always have ever since a small child, that life is too short and that death is terrible. And I just kept that. So it's kind of a personal insight, I call it. Others would say that it's a psychological problem or a philosophical mistake. But I consider it to be an insight that death really is a threat. It means extinction. Otherwise, I argument too, even if you don't have a kind of personal feeling that it's bad to be annihilated, you still have reasons to draw death as something strongly negative. So the big one is, of course, that death has an incredible opportunity cost.
Okay.
All those things that you can do makes it bad for you to cease to exist.
Okay, well, if you look through history on and off, of course, death has been a tool by some that have seen it happen to their loved ones or to their people as a tool that drives vengeance, Also, I hate to say it, there have been powers in charge that have used it for their ethical justification. How do you think people in today's world can try to cope with something that has such a vast array of interpretation and historical presence and past?
Well, cope with, of course, people will cope with death in different ways. I mean, the most common way globally is through the religion, which normally denies death in the sense that it says death is not real, in the sense that death is not the end, but it's a continuation. That's the most typical. I sit here in Sweden, which is a extremely secular country, and here many people deal with it by thinking of a kind of symbolic survival, perhaps. They see that they continue through their children or through some idea or project. Or they simply are not particularly, let's say, exercised by the idea of not existing anymore. So I just translated my book into Swedish. I hope that was what some of the Swedish philosophers say. And, you know, one says, I can't see what's so terrible about me ceasing to exist.
Okay. We have a lot more to talk about, so please stand tuned for the next segment of our show. This is ROI on KALA, St. Ambrose University, 106.1 FM.
In times of joy, in moments of grief, broadcasters come through, even when all else fails. Today, with more ways than ever to experience the moments that transform our lives, Americans still choose broadcast radio and television more than all other media combined. We are the local broadcasters of radio and television, reaching more people, touching more lives. Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hello and welcome back to ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, the radio show where events of history are examined through the discussion of books, journal articles, papers, and presentations. Then historians and history buffs ask the question, what is relevant or irrelevant in today's world? My name is John Keeley, and this is the second segment of our show, referred to as The Kitchen Table. Our noted guest for today is Dr. Patrick Linden, author of the book, The Case Against Death. We've talked about this book in the first segment, and right now we're going to talk with our history buffs about it, who are Rick Sweet and Brett Menard. So, Brett, why don't you start us off with this segment?
Patrick, you said that there's a lot of ways different societies cope with this idea of death, and a lot of it is through denying the badness of death. So what are the pros of longer life?
What pros of longer life are all those valuable things that you can enjoy because you're not dead?
That's true.
Okay, we got that there.
Pretty cut and dry.
Pretty cut and dry. Rick.
Patrick.
It's my almost economical argument for life, namely that the opportunity cost of death is too high.
Okay. Rick.
Yeah, my name is Rick.
Yes.
We're talking to Patrick.
Yes.
Patrick, just happens a kind of a sidelight here in the United States. The ROI team with some of its friends are doing a book group, and we have been spending the last several weeks reading a book about all the symbolism and theories about hell. And there are some religions that we've run across, like the Jewish religion, that basically when you're dead, you're dead. There is nothing afterwards. But everything else has come up with various motifs for what happens after somebody leaves this terrestrial plane. Is the your studies is the fear of death or acceptance of death, because when somebody gets so old that life is just too painful to live, death is something that is attractive, as opposed to death on a battlefield or a car accident or something like that. What is your survey looked at the rationale for religion to be a comfort or a scourge for what happens after you die?
It seems like it should be comfort. It will, of course, be individual, but there have been surveys on people's attitudes to radically prolong their life in this world, and really, there wasn't a big difference between people who saw themselves as religious and people who were less religious, which was surprising that the religious people were slightly more interested in radical life extension, that is scientific and extension in this life, despite their religiosity, where you might think, well, they would be less interested, perhaps, because they want to move on. So it's a bit of a surprising picture. So perhaps it is because their rejection of death is why they're religious, and maybe that's why they also would like the radical life extension. This is an underexplored area, really. There are studies, but that's what I've seen.
Okay, Patrick, so in your assessment, when doing your research and presenting the book, have you come across cultures, because you mentioned it is a cultural concept in many ways, where cultures cross paths and their interpretation of death varies greatly, where the outcome is obviously examined by both sides, and there's possible change, or is this part of human nature and it pretty much stays a constant with that culture?
Well, I mean, my book isn't really an exploration so much of different cultures. It's not so anthropological in that sense. It's more philosophical. And of course, you know, and mostly focused on the Western tradition. And so, of course, in that Western tradition, I see all kinds of ideas.
Okay.
So I can't really say that I have studied exactly what you're asking for.
Okay. Well, in your book, then, to ask from the research you did from a philosophical perspective, which mind, when they presented their interpretation of death, struck you to the core the most, if I may ask then?
Well, I'm someone who hopes for a life, but I'm also someone who is not persuaded about it. So I'm a skeptic, fortunately. So for me, I'm a reluctant Epicurean, right, who believe that this is what we have, and then there's nothing more. The only positive thing then about death is that your troubles are over. If you have troubles, your suffering is over, you cannot suffer. But of course, there are all those things that you can't do also that you value. So for me, that's not a big consolidation. In fact, I see our situation as just tragic, really. Okay. And I see philosophy as really being charged with the task of explaining why it's not as tragic as it seems.
Okay. Rick, I meant Rick, again, Rick. Brett.
So you, in your book, have titles of chapters like Life is Overrated and responding to that. It seems to be that death being bad is not true only if we have like really good anti-aging science and life extension. So the quality of the life being extended has to be at a certain level for continuing life to be good. So do you think that we're trending that way, that our old age is getting good enough to justify living longer? Or what's kind of, how did you think through when quality and quantity of life conflict?
Yeah, so that's right. So I see the badness of death as a function of the goodness of life. So when the goodness of life is over, then death is still bad, is at least bad alternative. So there are times when death is better than life, when life has no more quality in it, value in it. So what do I think? I think this. I think that it's important to shift to a paradigm where we attack aging directly in order to prevent us from getting old age-related diseases. So I think that there is danger if we continue in the current paradigm to just try to address one illness at the time as they appear in a reactionary way can lead to a prolonged, very low quality of life at the end of life. But I think if we could do something to slow down the aging process, then all of these frailties and mortal diseases would come later, and we have a longer stretch of quality of wildlife. So I also argue for a certain kind of shift in the science and research. Because, yes, of course, no one wants to prolong a life that's just full of hopeless suffering. On the other hand, I think, and this is very important, I think people are overestimating how healthy they need to be in order to want to live. So when I ask my students, for example, this question, many will say they want to be dead before 80 because they're afraid they would be like in a wheelchair. And I tell them there are a lot of people who live in wheelchair all their life. You don't have to be in perfect condition. And also many surveys, that's a survey from Stanford from 2015, where they asked people if they would want radical life extension, but they wouldn't be like in perfect physical health, but they would be in good mental health. And, you know, only about a third would want that. Only when you stipulated that people would be both almost perfectly healthy mentally and physically did they want to have radical life extension. I think that's completely a wrong a value judgment. That, you know, I have a father of 7, and he's certainly not 100% physically, but he still has great days, and we still values life a lot.
Okay, Rick,
Patrick, we have some states in the U.S. that allow what is called either assisted suicide or self-defined termination of life. And usually these people are people that, you mentioned goodness of life, their life is horrible, and they would just as soon end it quietly and peacefully. Did you discuss assisted suicide in your book?
I don't discuss it. I feel that in principle, morally speaking, it seems like a benevolent act, but I'm also skeptical to allowing the state and allowing a system where it becomes, let's say, I'm very skeptical to allowing the state the kind of prerogative and the doctors the kind of power to also end lives.
Well, it's usually based on the decision of the individual, and they actually have to have a court order to allow it to go through.
Yeah, but right now we have first of all, I feel that this is already happening. I know this is already happening.
Sure.
Decisions are made, and I know that you know, my dad was very, very sick recently, and Basically, they were ready for him to die, but he wasn't. And fortunately, he recuperated. And I feel that it's very dangerous to have a kind of culture where this is on the table. And I feel it can be something that's systematized, and old people might feel a pressure to end their life. I'm worried about this. Okay. But morally speaking, obviously, but I do think it can be benevolent for sure.
Okay, Brett.
So In your book, you do address the fact that there are problems for which death is a useful solution. So things like overpopulation. And resource hoarding by people who have had longer lives and more opportunity to obtain wealth. So how did you think through balancing out the case against death? I can see it on an individual level. Nobody wants to be the person to take the fall for the group, but the group needs somebody to take the fall at some point.
Yeah, that's really correct. So, it's one thing to make the case that it's bad to die as an individual, that it's an individual bad, but it might be that it's a social good, or it might be like a tragedy of the commons where it might be good for one person to have a radical life extension, but we all do it. We might have social problems like overpopulation and so on. So what I think is, I think that death or preventing people from living longer should be one of the last options, that we should think as creatively as we can of other solutions than old people dying. That is, so when it comes to overpopulation, I think, first of all, that this is a problem that's overstated, that more than half people of the planet are already living in countries that are either shrinking or stable. And the UN is projecting that there will not be a huge increase, and it will be stabilized at the end of the century, around 9 or 10 billion. Okay, but what happens if we live much, much longer? Well, I think that, first of all, we still trend with fewer children, and if we say, prevented aging completely, then I think we might have to accept some kind of control of how many children we have, rather. That's on at the extreme end. If you look at the countries where people live the longest, like Sweden, Japan, Norway, etc., many of those countries are shrinking because population growth is driven by fertility rates, mostly.
Okay. Rick.
But look for other answers than old people dying. That's my main argument.
I have a question that came to mind. You mentioned in the introduction that, as a young person, you viewed death as horrible. What do you see as the, in your own mind, what is the perfect death?
The perfect death.
Yes, we ask tough questions on ROI, yes.
I wrote the case against death. I think death is fearsome. It's something to be avoided. Perfect, there can be deaths, moral death. There can be death you do as a sacrifice to realize some other great value, to save other people, for example. That's heroic, of course. Just because death is such a bad personal.
But there would be an end game. There obviously we're organic creatures, and there's got to be an end game where all the machinery wears out. So
all biological living things die.
Yeah, but I think that's terrible. I mean, I want to argue that that's for a human being. I don't see us. I see ourselves as living very much from the inside, from our own personal world, and I see us as being on a kind of voyage where we try to construct something. We try to prove ourselves and so on. In some sense, the fact that ourselves and our machinery is falling apart is an affront to us.
Okay. It is customary that we give our guests the last word on the show. Patrick, why do you think knowing about the philosophical ideas surrounding death is relevant in today's world?
I think it's very relevant in today's world because we've never been in the position of actually being able to, through science, perhaps slow down aging and live substantially longer. So I think it's very important that we realize this and that we are honest and say, well, look, it's not a good thing to fall apart, even though biological things tend to do that. And it would be very good if we could live much longer. That's why I think it's important, because we can perhaps extend our lives at least a bit more.
Okay. Brett, why do you think it's relevant?
Well, so the annoying thing about death is it eventually happens to everybody, and a number of people choose to deal with it by ignoring it and pretending it won't happen to them. So anytime we can get people thinking about this idea of their own mortality and forcing them to confront something they might not care to, it's an unpleasant thing to think about, but it is a necessary thing to think about.
Rick, what's your perfect death?
Well, you know, again, some of my friends say they'll live forever, go to the celestial plane if that's the case. To be perfectly honest, Patrick, and audience listening, I have difficulty with this because I look at life as a continuum, and I do agree with Patrick that you know, when you die, you continue to live through your children. So I mean, again, it's a tough subject, Patrick, but I think you did a good job in making your case.
Yeah, Shakespeare writes a thing or two about that. When we come back, we'll wrap things up, so please stay tuned. This is ROI and KALA, St. Ambrose University, 106.1 FM.
You're listening to Relevant or Irrelevant. This series is produced at St. Ambrose University's KALA Radio and has been honored by the Midwest Broadcast Journalists Association and the Iowa Broadcast News Association for excellence in public affairs journalism. You can hear this edition of ROI and many previous programs in this series by visiting Spotify, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, plus Apple Podcasts. ROI airs Friday nights at 9:30 p.m. on KALA HD2 and can also be heard at 106.1 FM in the metropolitan Quad City area. You can stream this show every Friday night at tunein.com. Search for KALA HD2.
This concludes our 559th show of ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant. Our producer and engineer is Dave Baker. Our program manager is Rick Sweet. And the theme song for our show is titled Kayla's Theme, which was written and performed by Mark Zapp Zaptel. My name is John Keeley, and we would like to thank our noted guest, author Dr. Patrick Linden, who talked to us about his book, The Case Against Death. The history buffs for today's show are Rick Sweet and Brett Menard. This is ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, on KALA. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of St. Ambrose University or KALA. We would like to wish all our listeners to experience the great Basutu proverb, Hotso Pula Nala, peace, reign, and prosperity. And remember, historians are horrible fortune tellers. Good night.